Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 560, titled Economics 911. This is being recorded on July 9th of the year 2006. Before we get into the main body of the program, let me alert listeners, or remind listeners in the case of veteran members of the audience, that there is a vast amount of material available on the internet. Those of you who are only following the broadcasts themselves, the For the Record broadcasts themselves, are missing out on a tremendous amount of printed information. The greater part of the For the Record experience at this point can be found in print online. www.spitfirelist.com is the website for Spitfire, the CD duplication service that distributes this work. And in addition to the vast amount of material, program descriptions of article length, entire long out-of-print anti-fascist books available for download. There are links to a number of different websites, audio websites maintained by WFMU that have the entire For the Record series archived on audio file, and many other websites as well, a blog spot, a site maintained by listeners in the Midwest with the declassified documents about the Bush family's involvement with Nazi industry before, during, and after World War II. There's a tremendous amount of information available at every For the Record program is turned into an article-length description, so please, please, I can't stress strongly enough, take advantage of those descriptions. Also, there's a page to click on to support the work that I'm doing, and if you don't like what you hear here, there's no better way to do something about it than to support the work itself. Okay, more about that time permitting at the end of this side and or the second side. What we're going to be looking at in Economics 911 are some of the economic implications of September 11th and related topics, such as the invasion of Iraq. What has been taking place from an economic standpoint has been to a certain extent overlooked, and the more time passes, the more convinced I am that the economic aspects of September 11th and related topics are certainly as important, if not more important, than others. We're going to begin by taking a look at an article from Newsweek, from the MSNBC.com/Newsweek website. It's a very insightful article about the economics of the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, the Muslim Brotherhood is an Islamic fascist organization that began in 1928, was allied with fascist Italy and Nazi Germany. It then jumped in turn to British intelligence, the CIA, and finally came to rest under the auspices of Saudi Arabia, where it drew on the tremendous oil wealth of that country and also continued to be sponsored in various activities by elements of CIA and other intelligence services. The key there is the anti-communist and, above all, free market slash corporatist economic paradigm adhered to by the Muslim Brotherhood. In For the Record 455, among other programs, and this will be reproduced in the description for this broadcast, we specifically discussed the economic implication or the economic philosophy of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is corporatist, basically, along the lines of Mussolini's corporate state. Now, the Muslim Brotherhood is, of course, an Islamic organization, so that it differs in certain relatively small areas from classic fascism or even German National Socialism. But nonetheless, one of the important things to understand in assessing September 11th is that there are very powerful economic and political elements in this country that are allied with the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas, the MAK in Afghanistan, the Afghan Mujahideen, and Al-Qaeda are all offshoots of the Muslim Brotherhood, as is Palestinian Islamic Jihad. These are branches of the Muslim Brotherhood. And even as the United States is at war with the Muslim Brotherhood in various places, and some of the 911 conspiracists notwithstanding, it's a very, very real war, but it's a very complex situation. The fact of the matter is that because of the economic philosophy of the Muslim Brotherhood and because of some of the institutional investment connections between powerful elements in this country and powerful elements in the Muslim world, in fact, there are very significant power interests in the United States that are allied with the Muslim Brotherhood and its offshoots, at least philosophically, much the way that many of the members of the power elite in the United States during the Second World War were allied with the very fascists that the United States was fighting on the battlefield. Again, September 11th is a complex situation. One should not oversimplify it. But in terms of understanding how we could be both fighting a war with such an organization and yet at the same time elements in this country are in bed with it, understanding the Second World War would be a good paradigm to compare it to. Now, this article is called Islam in Office. It's by Stephen Glain, G-L-A-I-N, of Newsweek. It's from the July 3rd through 10th of 2006 issue. And one of the things that's pointed out here, and again, this is Newsweek, so it does not hit as hard as it could, but the Muslim Brotherhood's corporatist economic philosophy is absolutely consistent with laissez-faire globalist free market economics. And that, I suspect, is one of the major reasons why the Muslim Brotherhood has enjoyed the support of power interests in the United States, and why one finds, for example, when Operation Green Quest's raids of March 20th, 2002 took place, they revealed, among other things, very strong political and institutional links between the Muslim Brotherhood / Al-Qaeda / Hamas / Palestinian Islamic Jihad funding apparatus in the United States and the Bush administration and key GOP operatives like Grover Norquist. This article basically lays out, in I think fairly clear fashion, the free market philosophy of the Muslim Brotherhood, and it is because of this philosophy that powerful elements in this country are supporting the Muslim Brotherhood even as American fighting men and women are dying on the battlefield fighting against it. That was the case in World War II with classical and not and National Socialist fascism, and it is the case today with Islamofascism, and in turn the relationship between the Bush administration and the underground Reich and the underground Reich's relationship with the Brotherhood. Yeah, that's a mouthful, but listen carefully, because we're going to move from an analysis of the Muslim Brotherhood's free market philosophy to some of the institutional connections of the Muslim Brotherhood in the United States. Stephen Glain writes in the Newsweek issue of July 3rd through 10th, Islam in Office, it reads as follows. Judeo-Christian scripture offers little economic instruction. The book of Deuteronomy, for example, is loaded with edicts on how the faithful should pray, eat, bequeath, keep the holy festivals, and treat slaves and spouses, but it's silent on trade and commerce. In Matthew, when Christ admonishes his followers to, quote, give to the emperor the things that are the emperor's, unquote, he is effectively conceding fiscal and monetary authority to pagan Rome. Islam is different. The Prophet Muhammad, himself a trader, preached merchant honor, the only regulation that the borderless Levantine market knew. In Muslim liturgy, the deals cut in the souk became a metaphor for the contract between God and the faithful. And the business model Muhammad prescribed, according to Muslim scholars and economists, is very much in the laissez-faire tradition later embraced by the West. Prices were to be set by God alone, anticipating by more than a millennium Adam Smith's reference to the invisible hand, unquote, of market-based pricing. Merchants were not to cut deals outside the souk, an early attempt to thwart insider trading. Today, with a spiritual revival sweeping much of the Muslim world and with the Bush administration still keen on democratizing the region, it is worth asking how an Islamist movement would manage the economy. Since 2001, Islamist parties have made strong showings or won elections in 10 Arab countries, Morocco, Jordan, Lebanon, Turkey, Iraq, Iran, Bahrain, Egypt, Kuwait, and Pakistan, and the Palestinian Authority. And none are clashing with the West on free market economics. In Iraq, the supply-side economic reform plan submitted in 2003 by former U.S. Administrator Paul Bremer has survived with only minor revisions under Baghdad's new Shia-dominated government. An interesting test came in the January election in Egypt when the Muslim Brotherhood, the fountainhead of modern Islamism, took a fifth of the seats in parliament. Now the largest opposition party, much of the Brotherhood's appeal rests on its network of hospitals, schools, and charities, which are often superior to state services and help explain why the secular regime cracks down harder on the secular opposition than on the religious one. Fortunately for the reform-minded Prime Minister, Ahmed Nazif, the Brotherhood's economic agenda is largely consistent with his own, albeit with a more populist twist. The Brotherhood embraces free trade deals in general, but criticizes the government for failing to negotiate better terms for Egyptians. Though Islam tends to frown on tax collection, the Brotherhood supports tax reform, not abolition, and opposes a proposed flat tax as regressive. It even endorsed the recent decision to lift budget-busting food and fuel subsidies, but wants to use Egypt's ample natural gas reserves to finance a less painful transition to market prices. Quote, "It must be done gently," says Mohammed Habib, the Brotherhood's first deputy chairman, "with the objective of reducing the gap between rich and poor," unquote. Parenthetically, a lot of the rhetoric here sounds quite good, but the realities of practice are something else again. Continuing. In the 1950s, as the Brotherhood gained political momentum, it opposed President Gamal Abdel Nasser as much for his decision to nationalize the Egyptian economy as for his fierce secularism. Mohammed, says Yasser Abdo, a Muslim Brotherhood member and a former economist at the International Islamic Bank for Investment and Development in Cairo, quote, "believed in the private sector as the basis of productive activity," unquote, with a limited, unquote, state role. Today, Brotherhood parliamentarians remain anti-statist and staunchly anti-trust, citing a verse in the Quran, quote, "He who brings commodities to the market is good, but he who practices monopolies is evil," unquote. Not that any member goes as far as questioning the OPEC cartel. As Cairo University economist Abdel Hamid Abu Zayed puts it, Islam promotes, quote, "competition of a cooperative nature, not the cutthroat Western kind." Politically, at least, the objective of fundamentalist Islam is to restore the Islamic Caliphate, the unified Muslim kingdom of the 7th to the early 20th centuries that stretched from the Hindu Kush to the Strait of Gibraltar. This rhetoric turns more practical on the subject of trade. Quote, "If the ancient caliphate can revive itself," says Habib, who has a U.S. doctorate in geology, "it will happen through regional commerce," unquote. A Brotherhood in power, says Habib, would respect Cairo's free trade agreements, though the group appears to be divided over whether it would honor one with Israel. In the days of the Caliphate, Islam developed the most sophisticated monetary system the world had yet known. Today, some economists cite Islamic banking as further evidence of an intrinsic Islamic pragmatism. Though still guided by a Quranic ban on riba or interest, Islamic banking has adapted to the needs of a booming oil region for liquidity. In recent years, some 500 Islamic banks and investment firms holding $2 trillion in assets have emerged in the Gulf states, with more in Islamic communities of the West. British Chancellor of the Exchequer Gordon Brown wants to make London a global center for Islamic finance, and elicits no howl of protest from fundamentalists. How Islamists might run a central bank is more problematic. Scholars say they would manipulate currency reserves, not interest rates. The Muslim Brotherhood hails 14th century philosopher Ibn Khaldun as its economic guide. Anticipating supply-side economics, Khaldun argued that cutting taxes raises production and tax revenues, and that state control should be limited to providing water, fire, and free grazing land, the utilities of the ancient world. The World Bank has called Ibn Khaldun the first advocate of privatization. His founding influence is a sign of moderation. If Islamists in power ever do clash with the West, it won't be over commerce. Well, indeed, I think that article has some very important insights, and if some of the strange bedfellows that we find in connection with September 11th proves to be a confusing situation to unravel for many people, I think the Muslim Brotherhood's endorsement of free market economics helps, I think, for us to understand how it is that September 11th notwithstanding, American fighting forces have put an Islamic fundamentalist government in power in Iraq and done much the same thing in Afghanistan. Haven't spoken much about Afghanistan recently, but there was a well-publicized story in which an Afghani Muslim who converted to Christianity was basically forced out of the country under pain of a threat of death. Basically, he was going to be executed in accordance with Islamic law for converting to Christianity. That, I think, is as telling an act or as telling an element to reveal what is taking place in Afghanistan as any I can think of. If some of this seems hard to embrace, I think examining that article as well as the Muslim Brotherhood's corporatist economic philosophy as set forth in not only For the Record 455, but in the book Dollars for Terror by Richard LaBeviere, I think will help us to clarify the situation. Because indeed, for all of the anti-Al-Qaeda rhetoric that we hear from George Bush, and I don't doubt that he personally has no use for Osama bin Laden, the fact of the matter is, as set forth at great length in the book Dollars for Terror, the Muslim Brotherhood, because of its free market economic philosophy, is looked upon with great favor by the multinational corporate community. And American arms have been put, and also the American political impetus has been put to work supporting, quote, democracy, unquote, which has actually brought the Muslim Brotherhood to power in many areas that they were previously not in power. I would note that in places like Iraq, which had something of the Nasser Egyptian model of economics, and who knows, perhaps ultimately in Syria as well, the Muslim Brotherhood is being favored as an alternative to state-controlled economic systems. And I think that, and indeed, note that that Bush's push for democracy is helping to install Islamic fundamentalist governments of the Muslim Brotherhood variety in many foreign countries, and or strengthening them in countries that they are not yet the dominant element of, such as Egypt. Again, this would seem strange at first glance, but when one looks at one level, at the economic philosophy of the Muslim Brotherhood, it is at one with the economic philosophy of people like Grover Norquist and Karl Rove, the founders of the Islamic Institute, a Muslim Brotherhood slash Al-Qaeda slash Hamas area of intersection with the GOP and the Bush administration. One interesting thing before we go back, and we're going to touch on Grover Norquist, we're going to touch on Operation Green Quest, we're going to touch on the Islamic Institute. There's been a lot of rhetoric in the United States about the, quote, Israel lobby or the, quote, Zionist establishment having precipitated the Iraq War. I suspect a lot of that comes from the fact that there are a few Jews who are supportive of Israel who also were supportive of the Iraqi invasion. I think a lot of it comes from Paul Wolfowitz himself. Wolfowitz obviously has a Jewish last name. What a lot of the anti-Semites, and I think, frankly, their anti-Semitism is running rabid, particularly in the American, quote, left, unquote. Paul Wolfowitz isn't Jewish. He carries a Jewish last name. His father was Jewish. He carries his father's name, but he is not Jewish, does not practice the Jewish religion, and in fact has been romantically involved for the last several years with a Muslim woman from Saudi Arabia. His fellow traveler, so to speak, Grover Norquist of the Islamic Institute, has actually married a Palestinian Muslim woman and has been evasive on questions as to whether he himself has converted to Islam. But again, as we look at the bizarre political landscape, and a very terrifying political landscape it is, I think understanding the free market philosophy of the Muslim Brotherhood can help us to unlock some of these quandaries. A very interesting article was authored by Greg Palast, the American, well, he was expatriate, he's now largely based in the U.S. He authored an article for Tycoon magazine of July and August of 2006. It's called, Was the Invasion of Iraq a Jewish Conspiracy? Subtitled, Did the Jews Do It? It's dated June 26th of 2006. Palast, by the way, I'm not going to take the time to read the entire article. Palast is actually being ironic here, and one of the things he notes is that the ball game, so to speak, in Iraq was not produced by Zionists. Talking about something that has proved utterly disastrous in Iraq, which was the free market economics that were put in power and basically resulted in a kleptocracy in Iraq, He notes, basically, that the author of the free market economic program that was put in power after the American invasion of Iraq was most definitely not made out by Zionists or Jews. Greg Palast writes in the article, "It was more like a corporate takeover, except with Abrams tanks instead of junk bonds. Remember in this context the Muslim Brotherhood's economic philosophy at one with the economic philosophy of the elements behind the Bush administration." Beginning again and skipping down, "It was more like a corporate takeover, except with Abrams tanks instead of junk bonds. It didn't strike me as the work of a kosher cabal for an imperial Israel. In fact, it smelled of pork. Pig heaven for corporate America looking for a slice of Iraq, and I suspected its porcine source. I gave it a big sniff, and sure enough, I smelled Grover Norquist." Norquist is the copy of right-wing big money influence peddlers in Washington. Those jealous of his inside track to the White House call him Gopher Nose Twist. A devout Christian, and parenthetically he may now be a devout Muslim, a devout Christian, Norquist channeled $1 million to the Christian Coalition to fight the devil's tool, legalized gambling. He didn't tell the coalition that the loot came from an Indian tribe represented by Norquist's associate Jack Abramoff. The tribe didn't want competition for its own casino operations. "I took a chance and dropped in on Norquist's L Street office, and under a poster of his idol, Nixon, now more than ever, Norquist took a look at the recovery, unquote, plan for Iraq and practically jumped over my desk to sign it, filled with pride at seeing his baby. Yes, he promoted the privatizations, the tax limit for the rich, and the change in copyright law, all concerns close to the hearts and wallets of his clients." So again, note who the basic author of the privatization of Iraq was. It's Grover Norquist. And as we've seen in many programs, including For the Record broadcast number 454 and For the Record program number 515, Grover Norquist, as well as Karl Rove, were basically the driving forces behind the creation of the Islamic Institute. That is actually a Muslim Brotherhood branch, for all intents and purposes, of the Republican Party. And when the Operation Green Quest raids took place on March 20th of 2002, it revealed the most profound connections between the Muslim Brotherhood, elements that were funding Hamas, Al-Qaeda, and Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and the GOP. And the Bush administration. That's the same GOP and the same Bush administration that is now screaming bloody murder and basically pushing to have the editors of the New York Times tried for treason for talking about Operation Green Quest. Now, Operation Green Quest has been known for a long time. Its most important raid, the March 20th, 2002 raids, basically revealed strong links between the Muslim Brotherhood terrorist financing apparatus in the United States and the GOP. Furthermore, Operation Green Quest was transferred from the Treasury Department to the Department of Homeland Security. The Department of Homeland Security, of course, is headed up by Michael Chertoff, and Chertoff represented, when he was in private practice in the late 1990s, Dr. Magdi El-Amir, a prominent New Jersey physician who was an apparent financier of Al-Qaeda. So again, as one examines the rhetoric that the GOP is ratcheting up predictably in this election year, understand what lies behind it. Not only a tremendous amount of hypocrisy, but also a classic example of what at first glance would be strange bedfellows when you have Grover Norquist and Karl Rove and their ilk in bed with the Muslim Brotherhood. Well, that would seem pretty strange at first, but not when one examines the Muslim Brotherhood's economic philosophy, which is at one with those of Karl Rove, Grover Norquist et al. But also, as we'll see, time permitting later in the program, there are also very strong investment connections between the Saudis and other backers of the Muslim Brotherhood and the elements backing George Bush. Again, we have been treated in recent weeks with some of the, by now, almost routinely hysterical rhetoric that the Bush administration has cited, or has employed, I should say, to bash its critics. The following comes from a defense website, not a Department of Defense website, but it's defensetech.org, and it basically has the following, and this is an article that basically was put on their website. The full annotation will be available. It's called White House New York Times Bashers, quote, hypocrites, unquote. This is from June 28th of 2006. Again, the title, White House New York Times Bashers, hypocrites. It reads in part, since 9/11, nobody, and I mean nobody, has done more reporting on the government's attempts to track terrorists through their data trails than the National Journal's Shane Harris. The guy ate spam and knocked back tequizas with John Poindexter, for Christ's sake. So I couldn't be more psyched to welcome Shane to the Defense Tech family. This is the first of what I hope will be a long string of posts for the site. Bush administration officials have been lining up to condemn the New York Times for revealing a program to track financial transactions as part of the war on terrorism. But if the Times' revelations about a program to monitor international exchanges is so damaging, why has the administration been chattering about efforts to monitor domestic transactions for nearly 5 years? Shortly after the 9/11 attacks, many journalists, including this one, were briefed by U.S. customs officials on Operation Green Quest, an effort to roll up terrorist financiers by monitoring, among other things, suspicious bank transfers and ancient money lending programs favored by people of Middle Eastern descent. And skipping down, since 9/11, the Treasury Department has produced dozens of news releases and public reports detailing its efforts. Though officials appear never to have mentioned the SWIFT program, they have repeatedly described their cooperation with financial networks to identify accounts held by people and organizations linked to terrorism. Representative Peter T. King, Republican of New York, convened a hearing in 2004 where Treasury officials described at length their efforts assisted by financial institutions to trace terrorists' money. But he has been among the most vehement critics of the disclosures about the SWIFT program, saying editors and reporters of the New York Times should be imprisoned for publishing government secrets. Well, again, that is not only hypocritical, but when Operation Green Quest got into full swing, so to speak, in early 2002, the March 20th raids of that year revealed strong operational links between the Muslim Brotherhood's apparatus in this country and the fellow free marketeer philosophers of the Muslim Brotherhood, people like Karl Rove, Grover Norquist, et al. As I mentioned in For the Record 555, my most recent conversation with Daniel Hopsicker, what really is going on here is a money-go-round, and little things like wars, be it World War II or the current unpleasantnesses around the world, is not seen as particularly decisive by the powers that be. The idea is to keep the money going, and well, if poor slobs, maybe a few millions on each side, wind up dying, the idea is to keep the money going around. Do check out the other websites, link to www.spitfirelist.com, not only the For the Record section with long article-length descriptions of the For the Record broadcast, but there are numerous old and very important anti-fascist books available for download for free. There are audio files maintained by sister station WFMU. There's a blog sphere for the For the Record programs and the AFAs, and a wealth of material as well. Again, there's also a page to click on to support the work that I'm doing, and unfortunately my efforts aren't backed by the Muslim Brotherhood or the other corporatist free market advocates, so I'm kind of stuck there. But if you want to help out, it'll be certainly welcome. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 560, Economics 911. This has been recorded on July 9th of 2006. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.